Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was a Green Party candidate for president in 2020, and these Green Socialist podcasts are about continuing to discuss and advance the program we ran on. And I'm going to make some remarks on what happened this week and is coming up next week. We have a guest today, Logan Simmering, who's a Green candidate for city council in Cincinnati, and should be interesting. He's an iron worker, and he's got a lot of building trades union endorsements, which is, they're the more conservative unions generally, and Greens don't get a lot of endorsements. So I'd be interested to talk to him about that. So, as you know, the Republicans filibustered the Freedom to Vote Act, the Voting Rights Act, in the bill in the Senate this week. And so what happens now? Biden did say on that CNN town hall Thursday night that he was open to changing the filibuster for voting rights and maybe other things. But there's no sign that Manchin or Sinema are going to budge on the filibuster. And, you know, it's getting late. You know, Biden hasn't said much about it. The most aggressive thing he said about changing the filibuster was Thursday night. And the other thing I'll note is that, you know, there's a lot of media coverage on that vote going down, but none of it mentioned the elimination of the presidential public campaign funding program, which, as you know, I've made an issue of and tried to get the media to cover. And they just don't seem to care because it's only the Green Party that's taking advantage of it these days. You know, the reform should be to put enough money in it so that, you know, major party candidates that don't want to be dependent on corporate funding so much can use it instead, because, you know, it's like for the general election grant where you take that, you can't take private money. It was $100 million for the major parties in 2020. And Biden and Trump were spending hundreds of millions. Count the independent expenditures, it was about $3 billion for each of them. So you could increase that funding so that, you know, a major party candidate, you know, say a Bernie Sanders got the nomination, and he would take it. And it would be enough to run a serious campaign. But that seems to be off the agenda, and the Democrats want to take the money from that fund and put it into their sort of pilot program for congressional funding, which again is hard to qualify for if you're a third party. So that whole public funding aspect, in fact, some of the media says there is no public funding in it. Actually, there is. You know, the media should read the bill before they write about it. But I guess the excuse I'll make for them is the staffs have been cut so short, they don't have time to do thorough jobs. So sometimes they screw things up. The other thing I'll say about voting rights is, you know, Pelosi and Sarbanes pushed to cut $20 billion over 10 years from the reconciliation bill. That's about $2 billion a year. And that's when it was, you know, the original $3.5 trillion in the budget resolution that passed in August, which set a framework. And they got a cut out of that before all the cuts that have happened that we've heard about in recent weeks to the reconciliation bill, which is about half of what the budget resolution called for in August. And what they said, you know, Sarbanes is the prime sponsor of the For the People Act, which the Right to Vote Act is a pared down version of. They said they didn't want that money appropriated until they got voting rights passed because the Republicans in the states might use it for voter suppression. Yeah, they could. But the prospects of getting voting rights passed now are low due to the filibuster. And, you know, as the election administrators and the states that were saying, you know, we need this money or otherwise, and they're doing this. They're cutting polling places and drop boxes for mail-in ballots. There are a lot of counties in their states that they want to go to a paper ballot rather than these paperless voting machines. They need money for that. And so, you know, to increase voter accessibility and voter protection, these election administrators need money, but it's not in the reconciliation bill. It's not in any other legislation. And it's just worth noting that last week, the Senate Appropriations Committee gave another $10 billion for the military budget, $10 billion more than the Pentagon asked for. And that's five times the $2 billion a year that the election administrators need. So They got their priorities screwed up on both sides of the aisle down there. And then the other thing coming up this coming week, the reconciliation bill, they say they're going to vote on it, is that the climate program has been cut to the bone. The reporting this week is it's down to $300 billion over 10 years. That's about $30 billion a year. That's a drop in the bucket. You know, that compares to what the progressive Democrats were originally calling for last spring, $10 trillion over 10 years. That's 33 times more than what's now on the table. $10 trillion over 10 years, or $1 trillion a year, came from a lot of people that have studied this. The Roosevelt Institute, a liberal group, the Risky Business Project that headed up by Michael Bloomberg and Henry Paulson. Remember Paulson? He was the Treasury Secretary under Bush when they, you know, started to have to bail out the banks in 2008. That's a center-right kind of project, the Risky Business Project. The Political Economy Research Institute, another liberal group that's at UMass, headed up by Robert Pollin. All these groups are calling for about $10 trillion over 10 years. And Bernie Sanders, and like I said, it's 33 times more than what's on the table now. Bernie Sanders' Green New Deal, which was a serious proposal, the only serious one the Democrats had, 50 times more than what's on the table now. The Eco-Socialist Green New Deal that we campaigned on, $27.5 trillion over 10 years, it's 92 times more. And these studies and groups I'm citing actually did some research and you know, figured out what it will take, in our case, to get to zero emissions in 10 years. Bernie Sanders was zero emissions by 2050, but zero power emissions, which is a big chunk, by 2030. So he had a smaller overall number, but given the timeline he had, that was probably realistic. And these others, I don't know how they got to 10 trillion because they really don't get to zero emissions, but they're talking for a lot more. And so what we got now on the table as we head into Glasgow is just token. It's really not going to make that much difference. There are some studies that have been put out this week, whereas if they can get the best response for the tax credits and incentives that are going to go to utilities for clean energy and consumers for electric vehicles. And Biden does a lot of things he can do. We've been calling for, he should declare a climate emergency. There are a number of actions he could do by executive order. You get the EPA to treat carbon dioxide as a pollutant and pass stricter rules, although the Supreme Court hobbled Obama when he tried to do that a little bit, so there's that difficulty. And then if the states do a lot more, one study from a group called the Rhodium Group that's been sort of updating these estimates says, theoretically, you could get to Biden's goal of 50% cut in 10 years in greenhouse gas emissions if all those things happen. But there's so many ifs that it's unlikely. Meanwhile, you know, the social side of the reconciliation bill, they've totally cut out tuition-free community college, Medicare expansion, the child tax credit. They're now talking about 1 year, which means if the Republicans take back the House, it's gonna be hard to keep it. Child care, they're putting, you know, means testing and limits on it. It'd be a much simpler program if it was just run like they plan to do with the pre-K for ages 3 and 4. For the younger kids, just run it out of the school system like you're planning for pre-K. It's simpler, and you know, everybody has access, including rich folks. They can go to public school too, but it's a lot simpler to administer and actually probably cost less. You don't save that much by saying, people have to figure out how much is 7% of their income in order to qualify, and then above a certain level, you don't qualify no matter what. They just make it more complicated, and it's being cut back. And then taxing the corporations and rich to pay for it. Cinema is blocking all that, although they think they might get her to accept what they're calling an assets tax. It's really a wealth tax on billionaires to help pay for some of this thing. But we'll see what they finally come up with. I'll tell you one thing. I'm sick of hearing Pramila Jayapal from the, you know, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus cheerleading for Biden as this thing gets cut to the bone. He's approving cuts, and she's saying, well, the Build Back Better reconciliation bill contains most of everything progressives wanted. Yeah, in shrunken and, deformed form if they are passed. And I think it's time well, at least we need to recognize that we can't call defeats victories, because if we do that, we're always going to be defeated. So this Glasgow summit's coming up, and you know, we're in a dire situation. The on the agenda is what they call nationally determined commitments, or what's the C stand for? Commitments or contributions to cutting greenhouse gas emissions, to make them mandatory on the countries, or binding seems unlikely, but they're trying to get stronger commitments. But the United Nations Environmental Program came out with a report this week saying that the 15 largest fossil fuel producing countries, including the United States, are currently planning to produce twice as much oil, gas, and coal through 2030 as is needed to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And by 2040, it'll take until 2040 before those fossil fuels, the production of them peaks, which is gonna, you know, we're just gonna go right past this goal of 1.5 or even 2 degrees Celsius. So that's where we're at. And, you know, many are saying the Glasgow Climate Summit is the last chance. You know, I heard that before the Copenhagen Summit in 2009, which was supposed to replace, they had to replace the Kyoto Accords, which were expiring. And what happened there was Obama and the Chinese leader, who wasn't their top leader, it was Nguyen, who was the premier, wrote a little memo and then basically told the rest of the conference, take it or leave it. And that memo, which became the agreement, said no country had to commit to any carbon reduction reductions. They just had to, you know, state their aspirations. They could state whatever they wanted. And then Paris was where those were supposed to become firmer. And again, Obama administration pushed to make the commitments voluntary. So, and in Glasgow, they're going to try to make those commitments meet the need, these lower commitments, but they're still voluntary. The other big issue there is what they call climate debt reparations. And that's basically the rich countries paying the poor countries for the damages the rich countries have caused from global warming so far, and to help them make or build clean renewable energy infrastructures. And the commitments to that fund, which is called the Green Investment Fund, supposed to be $100 billion a year from the rich to the poor countries, has not been met. And it's been, you know, since Copenhagen, where it's first raised, 12 years. Biden has raised what the U.S. is committing. I forget the numbers right now, but I think it's $11.2 billion. And I think it's by 2030. I'm not sure it's yearly. And they want $100 billion a year. They're nowhere near close to that. And there was a study by a number of environmental groups like the Center for Biological Diversity, Friends of the Earth, 350.org, that said when Biden said we're going to go to 50% cuts by 2030, they said no, it needs to be 70% cuts, actually 195% cuts, because we got to help these poor countries reforest, where a lot of that carbon has gone into the atmosphere, and build clean renewable energy systems. So they recommended that we commit $800 billion over the next decade, or $80 billion a year. We're nowhere near that. And these are the kinds of things that need to happen. So you're going to hear a lot about Glasgow being the last chance. Like I said, I heard that before Copenhagen, I heard that before Paris. You know, we're not going to get what we want out of Glasgow. We'll see what we get, but it's not going to be enough. And it's not the last chance, because we got to keep going. And, you know, the Green New Deal that we've been talking about, global and eco-socialist, is what we're going to need. And it's going to be a sustained struggle. So people, you know, don't think it's the last chance. And if we didn't get what we needed, give up. No, we got to keep going. The last thing I'll say is that on this election coming up on November 2nd, you know, I've been arguing that one of the things Green's got to be doing is changing the rules of elections. We need ranked choice voting, particularly proportional ranked choice voting. But, you know, straight ranked choice voting from single member districts is on the ballot in three cities, Broomfield, Colorado, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Westbrook, Maine. So if you or anybody you know can vote in those elections, be sure to get a vote for ranked choice voting there. And then in Kansas City, Missouri, I think it's Missouri, not Kansas City, Kansas, but I think it's Kansas City, Missouri. They need 7,000 signatures by November 15th to put ranked choice voting on the ballot in the future in Kansas City. So there's an opportunity also for people to work on that issue. So I'm going to stop there. And let's bring in Logan. Logan Simmering, Green candidate for City Council in Cincinnati, Ohio, which actually had proportional ranked choice voting back in the day. And what happened there was Black folks started getting elected, so the city establishment decided to get rid of it, because this was in the 50s when civil rights movement was rising, and I guess those white folks didn't want to, you know, really have equal opportunity to be elected for Black folks. But so that's, we've had this before. We can't go backwards. That goes to the whole voting rights thing. So anyway, Logan is running in Cincinnati, and as I said earlier, he's an iron worker, got a bunch of building trades backing him, endorsing him. So, Logan, tell us about yourself and your campaign and the issues in Cincinnati.
All right. So, as you said, Logan Simmering, I'm an iron worker at a local 44 in Cincinnati, running for city council because, well, basically the modern world that we live in tends to disconnect and alienate us, make us feel powerless. And I want to build structures that'll push back on that so that, you know, the people can kind of take back control and set, push against the influence of especially, you know, predatory property developers in our city and other private interests like that, and make our city more livable and sustainable and democratic. So yeah, that's the short version. It's been extreme honor to be supported to the degree that I have been from the building trades. A business manager at my union has been really advocating for me behind the scenes with other unions. And they've really sort of come out with financial support and supporting me in other ways. So the big issues in Cincinnati that we're kind of focusing on is the affordable housing crisis. It's not nearly as bad here as it is in a lot of other places, but you can see it coming. We have some very predatory landlords buying up properties and kicking people out and jacking up the rent. A lot of things we want to do to push back against that. We have a huge amount of the city that used to be much more densely constructed that's been kind of abandoned over the last several decades. And it's time to sort of fill that back in and make something that's more walkable and cyclable and conducive to public transit that also needs more investment. Yeah, it's a hugely segregated city that we need to work on addressing those issues so that, you know, we don't have one neighborhood that's completely neglected sitting next to another that's hugely affluent with the stark color lines between them. All the sort of standard problems you see in cities across the country. We have lots of plans to kind of start fixing through popular power.
So is this city, is this election on the ballot nonpartisan?
Yes.
All but right. I did notice, I looked up a newspaper article, they identified y'all by party in that paper. So
yeah.
Like a lot of these nonpartisan races, the parties are in the background pushing their people.
Yeah, there's endorsed slates from four parties in Cincinnati, actually. The Democrats, the Republicans, the Charter Party, and the Greens.
And tell me about the Charter Party, because that goes back to ranked choice voting.
Yeah, they started the proportional representation back in 28, I think, with the, you know, to get Cincinnati politics from stop being run out of the back of a bar from the sort of local party bosses, and as a started, you know, the council manager system, which sort of continues, but the proportional system worked a little too well, and they got rid of that, which is a shame.
Yeah. Now, most people think the machine operating out of the bar, the political machine, was Democrat, but in Cincinnati, it was Republican.
Yep. Charter used to be closely aligned with the Democrats. Later on, they had a split because the Democrats didn't like sharing power. Charter got real weak for a while, but they're having a comeback since we had, especially this year, we had three Democrats indicted for corruption charges and a Republican. So that's been kind of a mess. A lot of people are not happy with the parties here.
Well, hopefully that bodes well for you.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a, myself, there's a DSA candidate that's looking strong, several independent candidates, and Charter has a full slate of people that, yeah, some of them are better than others.
Charter wants to bring back ranked choice voting? Is that their?
No, they have not mentioned that at all. A few of the other independent candidates have been talking about bringing back proportional representation and some other amendments to how we do elections, because we also are at large for the whole city, which makes, you know, representation kind of arduous. There's talk about bringing back districts or mixed at-large districts, various proposals, making council bigger. Nothing's very set in stone on that front, but people are talking about it because the current system's not working particularly well.
Well, it sounds like a good environment to bring a proportional ranked choice voting, because
yeah, we've definitely been talking about that. And also, I talk a lot about putting more power into the hands of the community councils that we have, which are independent community groups that the city recognizes and works with, gives a little money to. But the relationship with the city is very kind of unclear. I want to make it more definitive in the charter and use them as a vehicle for participatory budgeting, some other things along those lines.
So who's behind Charter? Are they just sort of the good government people?
That's what their line is. They tend to take a very, you know, in theory, ideologically neutral approach to good governments. That's how they present it anyway. Obviously, not really anything as such a thing as ideological neutrality, but
yeah, that's kind of unique to Cincinnati. I mean, that's the way the progressive movement wanted it.
Yeah.
They wanted city managers and fewer representatives and ranked choice voting or single transferable vote, proportional representation, to break up the machines. But they thought put the, you know, government in the hands of these technocrats. And what happened was, you know, working class people, women, black people, they all got in under those systems. And that's not quite what the middle class good government people had in mind.
Right.
Of course, the major parties didn't either. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I think there's some potential to, you know, get some of that back in the future, because we can sort of point to it working. And the reason that it went away was not that it failed, but that it really succeeded too much. So we'll be looking at it in the future.
Nine people up for election, nine seats.
Yep, nine seats are up. Only one elected incumbent is running. A few appointed candidates are running. 35 candidates by.
So it's sort of at-large plurality. So
yep,
you need about, 10% of the voters to say, we want you?
Something like that. I think 6% might have been what got people in last time. I've always been looking at the absolute numbers, which on the last election was like 22,000 was the cutoff, give or take.
Interesting. Yeah, that's another problem with those at-large plurality elections is you tend to get a plurality that, you know, supports one slate of candidates or another, and then they all get elected, or almost all of them.
Yeah. But a little bit open this year, so we'll see.
Yeah.
How things shake up in a couple of weeks.
Well, let's see if we got, I think we got some questions that have been put in the chat. So I'll give that a second, see if one of those gets placed in there. I guess, here we go. Dust James, lots of urban decay, no?
So some parts of the city have gotten a lot of reinvestment, revitalization in the last decade or so, particularly neighborhood over the Ride has been extremely gentrified. Other parts are just kind of abandoned, semi-abandoned, kind of rotting with very little investment. The trick is to as we move forward, have more investment without displacing people so that we can have a city that has less urban decay and is not replacing that with just trying to become a playground for rich people, especially rich people from the suburbs. Which got some plans to do that, bounced around social housing, community land trust, and making changes to sort of zoning rules, things like that, which hopefully we can get past.
Yeah, I wonder, do a lot of people from the more affluent suburbs commute to the city for their...
Or they did before the pandemic. Now they're... Now they work from home and are huge part, check of our tax base is in jeopardy.
Is the medical, the hospitals and whatnot in the city?
Yes. Yeah, we have a big cluster of them about a mile from where I live, where there are three of them. And then they have satellite offices and stuff like that, but... Most of the hospitals are in the city.
A lot of people make middle to upper middle, nice salaries, and they tend. And I'm going to ask, you guys don't have a local income tax, do you?
We do, about 1%, I think.
Oh, okay.
It's capped by the state. We can't raise it willy nilly, but without going to referendum. But we do.
And that includes people that earn their income in the city but live in the suburbs.
Yes.
Okay, that's good. I mean, I've been trying to get that in Syracuse forever, because basically people in the city are poor. People in the suburbs got nice salaries. They come in the city, they use the services, and then they go out to the suburbs where they pay taxes. They don't pay taxes here. The poor people got to pay for their services.
Yeah, we have a three-way mix of sales, property, and income tax to fund the city. So if any one league drops out on us, we're not totally out of luck, but budget is definitely in jeopardy going forward.
Eric Gray asks, Logan, what is your plan to build political power in your community along class lines?
A big thing I want to do is support worker cooperatives and also our local labor unions so that people have a place to organize along economic issues, and also to invigorate our community councils so that people in their neighborhoods are able to organize sort of trans class issues, and that those are kind of would intersect to build power for people who are lower income and just workers in general.
Isn't Cincinnati one of the cities that the steel workers used for a demonstration project on union co-ops?
Yeah, Co-op Cincinnati. It used to be Cincinnati Union Cooperative Initiative, which is a great project. I volunteer with them from time to time. Cincinnati Cooperative is organized through the steel workers. And it's a shame they're a big project to get a train manufacturer through Mondragon fell through, but they're chugging along. They're organizing lots of cooperatives. I think they have like a dozen in the works at the moment and five operational. And my hope is to leverage the city to support that effort and expand it significantly.
Wow, I didn't know it had developed that far. I mean, it sounds like a serious project.
Yeah, they're doing well for themselves. They have a symposium in November 6th, I think, bring people together nationally for cooperative issues, which people should check out.
Amy L. Sachs, Logan, what is the first issue you tackle in your town if elected?
My plan for first legislation to try to get get in is a renter's bill of rights. So that tenants have, you know, considerably more legal protections than they do against landlords who are extremely predatory and neglectful in this city. That's issue number one. And from there, move on to more housing stuff and then start looking into charter amendments to build more power into the community councils and look on electoral issues, things like that.
So the community councils are elected by different neighborhoods, or are they sort of volunteer organizations where everybody can just come to the meeting?
Yeah, the kind of volunteer organizations, you have to become a member of them. Different ones have different rules. But what I like to see them, you know, sort of evolve in the way of, you know, democratic town hall, town meeting type assemblies that would, you know, confederate to exert power themselves. I do not have an Ohio accent. I grew up in Maine.
Yeah, what you
at the comments there?
Go ahead.
I said I was looking at the comments. Someone was asking where it's from, and you said the. Sound like I have an Ohio accent. I grew up in Maine, so I don't think I have an Ohio accent.
Yeah, I was going to say, what you're talking about with community councils basically becoming community assemblies and having real power is probably the most radical thing in your platform. Because
yeah, it's kind of the central like radicalism of it.
Yeah, I just want people to think about that, because if you had like in New England town meetings where people come together and they can vote on policies, and then, you know, make their representatives in the city council accountable to them, then the people are directly involved year round instead of electing people to office and then hoping they do the right thing. It's something I think that's what the Greens should mean by grassroots democracy.
That is absolutely what I'm getting at. There are a lot of things that I want to do in the town, but that is sort of the real crux of my campaign, is to empower people through
democracy. Were these community councils encouraged by the city, or did they just grow up organically?
Some of them are very old, and I think they sort of pushed for the city to kind of recognize them. And others, once this was sort of established, an established thing, I think the city encouraged them to happen. Not every neighborhood has one still, too. I think there are three or four that don't out of the 52 neighborhoods in this city. And they're very unequal in how effective and active they are, which is something that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, my city, Syracuse, and a number of cities have sort of created these from the top down in the name of, participation, but they're really set up to be sounding boards for the city establishment and developers. So they bring their plans to here they're called Today's Neighborhoods Tomorrow or something, Tomorrow's Neighborhoods Today or something like that, TNT. And what they really are is a sounding board so the politicians and developers can find out where the resistance is coming from and figure out how to deal with it. They're purely advisory. And you can have empowered neighborhood or community assemblies, and you can have things that are set up basically to steamroll stuff through the neighborhoods. So I'm just telling people, you got to, be careful, look at what you got.
As it is now, they're a little more towards the advisory section. Some of them do have some really great projects that they do on their own. It varies a lot from neighborhood to neighborhood. But that's a big reason I want to kind of clarify the relationship with the city so that they actually have like powers spelled out in charter that can't be pushed aside.
Yeah, another issue that comes up, it sounds like it's true in Cincinnati, is some neighborhoods got people get involved and they're pretty active. Oftentimes, in my observation, it tends to be the well-educated middle-class neighborhoods. And the rich neighborhoods aren't targets for developers, and the poor neighborhoods don't get a lot of participation. So part of the process of developing real neighborhood assemblies is the city's got to provide support and staffing so mm-hmm. that people know when the meetings are, and the assemblies have some people with expertise and skills that can help them do what they want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a lot of how it is here. The most active and effective assemblies are in the more wealthy neighborhoods. Some of the ones that are doing interesting projects on their own are in poorer neighborhoods, which I appreciate. But I definitely want to make sure that they have like adequate support from the city and adequate infrastructure to be able to function as a real democratic power based on their own.
Cincy, can healthcare be fixed at the local level?
I have some ideas along that line. So there's not a ton we can do. I would like to establish kind of a healthcare core that operates with volunteers backed by some professionals to do like frontline stuff. So yeah, preventative medicine, making checks on people, things like that. Just make sure they're sort of connected to the healthcare system. I would kind of like to look into working with other cities to establish a kind of networked public health system, but that's very conjectural. There's opportunities, but it's hampered a lot by the sort of weight of the national system.
Gary Brown asks, Logan, any plans to encourage or work with mutual aid groups?
Personally, I do work with some mutual aid groups, and yeah, I would like to see city resources being directed into their efforts so that they can reach out to the community more effectively and actually provide resources to that, you know, very grassroots-based mechanism.
Ashley R., how do you recommend implementing grassroots activism in undereducated, hyper-religious rural communities where intersectionality is greatly misunderstood?
That's a million-dollar question, isn't it? Fortunately, I don't live in one of those communities, so I don't have to deal with it too much. But I think just try to talk to people and find what common ground you can, chip away at it, and build connections is sort of the best you can do.
Yeah, I agree with that. We got to, I've talked about deep canvassing in the past. So if you're living in one of those communities, you got to go out and talk to people and, you know, listen as much as you or more than you preach at them. And, once you hear where they're coming from, you can talk about, you know, where you're coming from as a Green and, you know, point to the, you know, common concerns and, you know, how your policies might help. And then be active on issues, because while there's cultural differences, on economic class issues, there's a lot of common interest. And it's probably where, you know, the commonality and the intersectionality can be built. That's what Reverend Barber is trying to do in West Virginia right now with the Poor People's Campaign and putting pressure on Manchin. And he among, you know, sort of progressive leaders that are, although he's nominally an independent, he's pushing the Democrats. He's very clear on the intersection of race and class. Some people tend to push one or the other, but you can't have racial justice or class solidarity without mutual support. So, you know, deep canvassing is what I'm getting at, or relational organizing, as they call it in the labor movement. So that's my advice if you're in one of those difficult rural communities. Dust James asks, what kind of response do you get from doing public outreach?
Almost always positive. People like the idea of being empowered. They like the idea of addressing the affordable housing crisis. They like the idea of a city that's walkable and livable, and pleasant to be in and affordable. Whether that translates into votes, we'll see. But people like what they have to hear from me.
Yeah, I find people like to hear from you just because you knocked on their door, mm-hmm. and nobody else has. And it's like, if you're ready to listen, some of them will pour their hearts out to you.
Yeah, I've gotten some of that.
And even if they don't agree with you, they just like you because you showed up and listened. So, you know, I think that's, particularly in these local elections, that's where Greens can get elected by people that agree with us on policy-wise and by other people that just appreciate the fact that, you know, we're there at the grassroots and concerned.
Yep. Absolutely.
David Ellison, here in Cleveland, we're intentionally trying to organize across neighborhood lines beyond the wealthier neighborhoods where the developers are having a heyday. We've had two mayoral candidate forums and have participation from both sides of town, black, white, male, female. It takes listening and actually hearing. It's clear elected officials and the developers are the problem, and assisted by the Community Development Corporation and the Planning Department with other urban quote unquote planners. Yeah, I think that's...
Is that a question?
I think it's a comment on what's going on in a lot of our cities and how this green is trying to deal with that problem. Yeah, before we get to Andrea's question, I was going to say that Cleveland has something that I think a lot of cities should model. They got something called, I think they're called the Evergreen Cooperatives. So they got one, they got a bakery, they got a greenhouse urban garden, and they got an industrial laundry. And basically the organizing got Case Western University and the Cleveland Clinic, which are in the middle of a poor black neighborhood, to help fund these co-ops. And I know we got a situation like that in Syracuse that could be done. You've heard about this Democratic socialist who got won the Democratic primary in Buffalo, India Walton. She's from a neighborhood that's being encroached by a medical complex instead of helping that neighborhood develop. And I imagine, you know, you said you live near a medical complex. It's a situation in a lot of cities. Cleveland provides a model to get some co-ops started that help the people in these low-income neighborhoods as well as relate them to these big nonprofits, the EDs and MEDs.
Yeah. Evergreen's a model of using institutional anchors for co-ops is really smart. It's definitely something more places should be emulating.
What happened to Andrea's question? Oh, well, she'll get back because she's picking the questions. You can do green urbanism and architecture too.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely want, you know, when we're building social housing and other publicly backed construction, to make sure the architecture is designed sustainably and that it's, you know, built into the sort of fabric of the neighborhood effectively so that it's sustainable and ecologically sound, energy efficient, energy, you know, passive as much as can be.
Andrea Merida Cuellar. Logan, you said you could see a housing problem on the horizon. Can you say more about that and what do you see?
Rent in Cincinnati is relatively low. It's been increasing very rapidly, though. And so are, you know, housing prices to buy homes. But, you know, we can look around at other cities and see where it's much, much higher. And we want to avoid the sort of issues that other parts of the country are having that are starting to happen here before they get too much worse. Just make sure that housing is affordable, decommodified as much as possible, and treated as a human right.
Emil Sachs. Cam Gordon, who is a Green on the Minneapolis City Council, has spoken about his city council's work to get tenants legal representation when they face eviction.
Yeah, that would be a part of the Tenants Bill of Rights I want to put forward. It's one of the more important provisions. It's guaranteeing representation during the eviction.
Ashley R., I do live in one of those areas, South Central PA. Thanks for your answer. I think these is one of the rural communities. In addition, how do you recommend addressing rampant transphobia and COVID-19 misinformation along the way?
I mean, I think the best thing you can do is sort of establish a rapport so people have some degree of trust in what you're saying and try to be consistent, but also sort of respectful of their views, regardless of how unpleasant they may be in correcting them. But I don't know. These are very hard questions in organizing, and I don't know if there are right answers, and I doubt that I have them.
Well, I think the trust thing you bring up is really important, because a lot of this, you know, transphobia and COVID-19 misinformation, it's not rational, or they don't trust sources that do provide real information. And then you got the whole social media thing where the most extreme crazy stuff gets amplified by the algorithms of Facebook and Twitter. So people, I mean, I was doing phone calls for a Green candidate for city council, Connor Mulvaney in Pittsburgh. And I remember calling one young woman who had three kids, making a lot of noise in the background. She was having trouble focusing, but she was just complaining that she didn't know who to believe. You know, she listens to Fox and she listens to CNN, and they're totally opposite. And she doesn't have time to figure out, you know, who these people are. And, you know, she's just very frustrated. So I think, you know, a lot of people that have these attitudes, it's peer pressure and kind of noise that's in the atmosphere. And they're not going to hear you unless they know you and trust you. And then you can start to have a conversation. It may be a long conversation, but at least, you know, like at work. I'm sure there are iron workers that, you know, probably got some bad attitudes. Mm-hmm. I know I had them among the Teamsters. But if you respect each other and listen to each other, you can have progress over time. So I think you got the right answer. You got to build trust.
Yeah, it's a hard, torturous journey to deal with some of these issues and people's attitudes, but all you can do is kind of keep plugging away at it, unfortunately. And sometimes people will have epiphanies.
Well, keep plugging away. That's another important thing. We can't just write these people off to the, you know, let the Republicans monopolize them with their crazy agenda. You know, we got to contest. If that's where, you know, if those are people you're working with or living with, you know, you gotta be engaged. So John Eric Hegstad, do your local cops even wear masks? Ours don't. How can we get people to acknowledge climate change when they can't even understand masks?
Yeah, some of the cops wear masks, but a lot of them don't. And yeah, I mean, that's just a mess. I don't know. So much of like understanding these issues is being very like tribalized. And I don't know how to get through the people along a lot of the stuff other than just keeping out there with what I at least think are the right answers. But yeah, you look at a lot of misinformation and the way people have internalized it, it's discouraging.
One thing,
especially just to give people, like cops.
Yeah, my gut wants me to ridicule the cops who act like such dummies. I mean, COVID-19 is killing more of them than any other cause. And they seem to have a peer pressure thing where, you know, we're tough guys and, you know, we're right wingers, so we're not wearing masks, even though they're endangering the public. So that's one thing. The other thing, I think, just to put an optimistic spin on it, I remember during the Vietnam War, you know, a lot of World War II veterans, auto workers where I lived, were very pro-war. But some of their kids started coming back in body bags or, you know, messed up physically or mentally from being over there. And then the Tet Offensive happened, and Cronkite and other somewhat respected people were saying, you know, we can't win this war. And those people, like, one day they were all pro-war, and in a very quick time, they all flipped. And what that tells me is, in the back of their mind, as the anti-war movement was speaking out and what, you know, the reality of the war was hitting them, they were changing their mind. Maybe they didn't even realize it consciously. So that sometimes, you know, public opinion will flip. Look at gay marriage. I mean, the support for that went from very low in about 2005 in 5 or 10 years to majority support. So these things can change very quickly. And if we put out arguments and people are resistant, maybe that means they're trying to defend their own position for themselves. So that's just to give people hope that these things can change.
Yeah. Do we have more questions?
I think Andrea's probably looking. Here we go. Picture this new media, Ernest L. Pena. How would you feel getting a celebrity sponsorship and donation to help you get noticed?
Depends on the celebrity, I guess.
Yeah, we just had this discussion in New York because we're getting ready to put together a statewide slate. You know, and when they ran me for governor in 2010, I was a nobody. Still am, really, in terms of celebrities. And we got enough votes 2 times to get, you know, a ballot status. We lost it in 2020. And so we were throwing around a few celebrity names. But our experience in New York is, I chased, what's his name? A black actor, Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis. I chased Ossie Davis around a full employment conference begging him to run for governor in 94. He kept telling me I had to run. I had no idea I eventually would. It's tough, you know, because some of them don't want to put their neck out like that. They got fan bases that are all over the place. So on the other hand, you know, we did get on the ballot with Al Lewis, Grandpa Munster, for those that remember, in 98. And Ralph Nader, who was not a, you know, entertainment celebrity, but, you know, household name. We ran him for president. It got us some attention, although the media pretty systematically marginalized and ignored him. So celebrities can only take you so far.
For sure.
So I guess Kat Paradis was thanking for answers. What we got? What was that question? Violet at Content Boutique. How do you feel about reparations for descendants of slaves?
Absolutely necessary. I think that's something that needs to be kind of a national project. But in general, you know, I want to focus on making sure that resources are going to in the city that are to these communities that are predominantly black that are extremely marginalized to kind of undo some of the damage that's been done over the last several hundred years.
Violet at Content Boutique has another question. What will you do to end qualified immunity for cops?
I would advocate for state representatives to deal with that. That's not something we can handle at the city level, unfortunately. But
Yeah, I was just
reading. The Supreme Court's making it so states can't handle it either, but it's definitely something that needs to get away.
I just read about a case in Ohio and Cleveland today about a black man that was killed by two cops. He was asleep in his car. One of them jumped in the car and ended up shooting him 5 times, killing him. I mean, the guy was just waking up. He
can't deal with this anymore.
Yeah.
These cops.
And they got off because of qualified immunity. That's what the courts decided.
Yep.
Yeah, that's got to go. Well, we're getting close to the end of the hour, Logan. Unless another question pops up, you want to give people, you know, some final words about your campaign and how they can help?
Yeah. So my campaign is all about building solidarity with the community. If you want to help, my website just popped up. You can read a bit about more about me, follow me on social media. Donations are always welcome, as many, many local campaigns I've told you for years now. You can also visit my volunteer section. If you're interested in phone banking, we can arrange some distance application there and amplify my campaign as you see fit. I appreciate any and all expressions of support.
Well, thank you, Logan. And I do see a question in the chat that I'm going to answer. Is that the city council advocates for national popular vote? I think that's a national popular vote compact. A number of states have done. And, you know, city councils can push for it.
We can advocate, but we can't pass it.
Right. But I was going to say that an article by Rob Ritchie and some lawyers that is now in the Harvard Law and Policy Review. It's online. So, you know, Google Harvard Law and Policy Review. And it's about how Congress could pass a law without a constitutional amendment that would render the Electoral College irrelevant because you'd have a national ballot and they go through the, you know, provisions of the Constitution that enables Congress to do this. So we now have a way to get to a ranked choice national popular vote for president. And that's up online now. I've mentioned that before, but it's up online now. And meanwhile, you know, the next couple of weeks are local elections. I hope people will help Logan. There are other green candidates you can help. Some are phone banking. And you can help with that no matter where you live. Also, I mentioned the ranked choice voting referendums in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Broomfield, Colorado, and Westbrook, Maine, and the petition in Kansas City to get ranked choice voting on the ballot. All that's going on right now. And of course, this is where at the local level, we can make the biggest difference. You know, I don't want people to get too discouraged when they see what's in or what's not in this Build Back Better reconciliation bill, which they say they're going to pass next week. And then what comes out of the Glasgow Climate Summit is totally inadequate in terms of, you know, dealing with this climate emergency. Like I mentioned, that UN Environment Program study came out this week. The nations of the world are planning to produce, what was it, twice as much oil, gas, and coal than we should produce in order to have any chance to stand below 1.5 degrees Celsius global warming. So, no, you know, don't be disappointed. At the local level, we can make a difference. And, you know, as I say many times on these podcasts, we got to build strong, mass-based local parties. That's where the deep canvassing goes in. We got to go beyond, you know, the normal people who will right away come to an appeal for green activity or action to other people that ought to be with us, but don't know about us, or they don't know us well enough to trust us. And we got to build that trust. So, you know, running for office like Logan is part of the way to do that, but we need to be doing that year round. You know, being out there talking to the people, knocking on their doors, listening to them, and being active ourselves, not just in elections, but, you know, with issue campaigns throughout the year. I think that's what we got to do. And, you know, the old left, the Communist Manifesto said we got a world to win. You know, we literally do now with this climate emergency. So I hope everybody keeps the fighting spirit and stays active. So everybody have a good weekend and a good week.
Thank you for having me on. It was a great pleasure. Thanks for an honor.